Hello and welcome to the podcast, A Very Brief Introduction to the British Empire. This podcast is run by Uncomfortable Oxford, a student-led social enterprise that runs walking tours and public engagement events in the city of Oxford. Today's episode is titled The First World War, and we have guest speaker Jack Doyle. My name is Paula Larson. I'm co-director and co-founder of Uncomfortable Oxford and a doctoral student in the history of medicine.
And my name is Olivia Durant, co-founder and co-director of Uncomfortable Oxford. I am also a doctoral student in global and imperial history at the University of Oxford.
And my name is Vikas Mirza, and I'm also a DPhil student in French and English literature at the University of Oxford.
So our speaker today is Jack Doyle, or should I call him Dr. Jack Doyle? Because although Jack was one of our fellow doctoral students, up until very recently, he is now a fully fledged doctor. So congratulations, Jack.
Thank you. It still feels weird to say.
Well, we are looking forward to it ourselves. Jack wrote a dissertation on the aviator myth, British, American, and French fighter pilots as combatants and cultural icons. And today he will tell us about how the First World War is very much a global war and, may I say, an imperial war as well.
So thank you very much for having me, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here. As Olivia said, my work is on aerial violence during the First World War. I was, until very recently, a member of Oxford's Globalizing and Localizing the Great War network, which brought international perspectives together on the First World War during the war's centenary, which recently finished. And now we don't talk about the First World War anymore, I guess. But I'm going to be talking today about the First World War as an imperial conflict. So I'm going to be doing that in a couple of different ways. First, I'm going to give you sort of an intro to the scope of the war. A lot of us are really familiar with the tropes of the First World War, which I'm going to talk about, especially in British memory. But I'm going to talk specifically about two aspects of the war that coincided with the military campaigns of the war, which is anti-colonial rebellion and revolution, and also the creation of the white Commonwealth in the case of the British Empire. So really the creation of distinctive 20th century white nationhoods and rhetorics about race that are maybe underplayed in terms of thinking about the First World War. So the First World War that I'm talking about today, as I mentioned, looks very different from the one we invoke on Remembrance Day in the UK. So I'm an American who moved to the UK about 10 years ago, and I remember my own introduction to how many British people commemorate the First World War as being this weird mix of moving, uncomfortable, and confusing. Seeing literally everyone bustling around central London wearing a poppy in November felt significant to me as an 18-year-old who was really interested in history. Getting to grips with what many British people described to me as a pointless war and a generational loss was a little more difficult. The way that everyone from war poets to my friends described the First World War was as this massive, unfathomable loss that defied explanation, but had also made Britain what it was today. So as I became a First World War historian, I started to realize that some of the unease I felt about things like the two-minute silence and the national insistence on wearing poppies was because this version of the war was distinctly British. It combines a nostalgia for the British Empire with a real lack of insight or sometimes interest in the British Empire's actual scope. When most British politicians invoke a First World War British soldier, they're usually talking about a white English soldier in a PALS battalion slogging through the muddy trenches and no man's land of Belgium and France. And they're almost never talking about, say, a Sikh sepoy in Mesopotamia. They rarely mention who that white English PALS battalion Tommy thought he was fighting, which makes it so much harder to understand why the British Army followed that Sikh soldier's footsteps into Iraq almost 100 years later. That kind of rhetoric has resulted in this weird, not particularly historical fetishism of the First World War that we're seeing play out in real time right now with racists defending the boarded up cenotaph in central London. But it's also why even those of us from all over the world who want to know more about the First World War often don't get to go beyond reading like Western Front war poetry in school. So that's why I think we really need to talk about the First World War as an imperial conflict, which is what I'm going to do today. I think a good way to think about this war is that it violently transformed 19th century imperialism into new imperial entities. So in the case of some powers, like the Russian, Ottoman, Austro-Hungarian, and German empires, it effectively broke those systems of imperialism. So literally, it dissolved systems of governance, radically redistributed resources and communal identities, and capitulated to colonial self-determination in many cases. First World War also literally made empires. So with the United States filling the vacuum left by many exhausted European powers on the world stage. In the case of the British and French empires, things were a little more complicated. These powers technically won the war, but their vast, literally global overstretch demonstrated the fragility of imperial power. So these empires didn't truly collapse, but they did have to reconfigure, say, the 19th century power and expansiveness of the British Raj into a 20th century imperialism.
So can you maybe give us an idea of how vast the British Empire was at that point, like during the First World War, and how vast it ended up being with the collapse of other empires at the end of this conflict?
Yeah, so kind of at the end of the 19th century, you know, we've got the scramble for Africa. Britain is a major player in that. They're also really starting to consolidate power in the Middle East as the Ottoman Empire is collapsing. There's also, as I'm going to talk about, this real tension between especially France and Britain and Germany in Africa, because Germany is starting to emerge as this new imperial power. So as I'll kind of touch on, the empire, the British Empire, is actually the biggest it ever is right after the First World War. But that doesn't necessarily translate to them having a what we might think of as like a good hold on those countries or necessarily the same kind of imperial relationship that it had to its colonies in previous centuries.
Yeah. Just for individuals to frame their mindset, what you said is absolutely correct in that the Western Front is what most people conceptualize as the First World War. Can you talk a little bit about what other fronts there were in the conflict and what other areas of and theaters of war existed?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to get into this a little bit, but technically some of the earliest casualties, you might say, of the First World War are in places that, you know, most people wouldn't expect necessarily. So the German attacks on ports in Algeria and in southern part of Africa. There are campaigns throughout the war in East Africa is a really contentious place. Southern Africa, North Africa, there's sort of a central European Italian front. There's the Eastern Front with where that kind of transforms as Russia collapses as an empire. There's campaigns in the Middle East, which kind of incorporates North Africa and Egypt. And you can see that the geography of these campaigns all really map onto existing imperial holdings. There's also obviously naval components to this that involve some parts of Latin and South America. North America is not so affected by the military aspect of the conflict, but like vast numbers of people are mobilized from those places. So as is true of Australia. So really we are talking about involvement globally in one form or another.
So I'm just wondering about the label itself, World War. So how come a label which or a title which clearly indicates, you know, the scope of the global has been popularly reduced to the Western Front? Why has it not been named the Western War instead of the World War War?
Yeah, that's a great question. So part of it is that the majority of white British soldiers fought on the Western Front. And so like popular perceptions of engagement with the front in terms of like you know, families actually communicating with their soldiers on the front from Britain was really focused around Belgium and France. But obviously that wasn't true. There were, you know, everywhere there were white British soldiers deployed all over the world. And so I would say the reason that we often imagine in Britain the First World War as being just fought in the trenches of the Western Front is a lot of it has to do with both Anglocentrism and at the time just the speed of communication as well. It was really easy to get information, newsreel footage, photographs from France and Britain. And so that very quickly translated into the popular experience of the war in the British public eye. There was an awareness, certainly, of the wider imperial involvement in the war, the global scale of the war. But I think a lot of it has to do with communication and what was available.
So maybe we could even say that the way it was taught and talked about, it wasn't the World War, but rather the Western White World War?
Well, as we're going to get into in the podcast, there is definitely an awareness of it being a world war because of the impact that it has in especially colonized nations and the language that people use who are not directly impacted by the European war to refer to the war very much reflect its status as a world war. People are, you know, connecting their personal struggles to what is being asked of them by imperial powers. You know, often they will refer to it as like the European war, but I think it is worth calling it a world war because it truly does often has far more material impact on countries that are not in close proximity to the Western Front. So basically, I'm saying, like, to understand the full legacy of British imperialism, we have to look really hard at the processes and conflicts of empire at the start of what we call the short 20th century, which is basically this idea historians have to talk about sort of the beginning of the First World War to the end of the Cold War. To do that, as I said, I'm going to look at two processes that occurred simultaneous to the military campaigns of the First World War. So anti-colonial rebellion and the creation of the White British Commonwealth. I want to demonstrate that these cultural, legal, and military processes were all equal parts of the First World War, and that they determined how present-day maps and conflicts look. So I want to give you an idea of just how global the First World War really was, how its impact on the UK as we know it today is actually nowhere near as significant as it was on many colonized countries, and to introduce you to the kind of imperialism that took Britain through the First World War into the 20th century. So I'm going to give you some numbers and fast facts, not to bore you as historians do, but to try to help you understand like what a conflict that we so often imagine is small, as you know, people dying over patches of field in northern France, has to actually do with vast empires and every continent. So quick intro. There's been lots of debates over why the First World War started and who started it. People usually point to Gavrilo Princip, who was a 19-year-old Bosnian Serb who assassinated the Austrian Archduke Franz Ferdinand and his wife Sophie on the 28th of June, 1914. This often gets skated over as this kind of random, almost accidental stumbling into war, this random, like, anarchist violence. The assassination itself certainly wasn't well planned, and involved many of the conspirators, including Princip, almost botching the job. At his own trial, though, Princip describes his struggles explicitly as being part of an anti-imperial struggle. So he kind of sets the tone for how I want to think about the war. He says, "I am a Yugoslav nationalist aiming for the unification of all Yugoslavs, and I do not care what form of state, but it must be freed from Austria." So this kind of rhetoric essentially set off a chain reaction of responses from European imperial powers, who all had these really complicated legal, political, and economic alliances and rivalries with one another. Trying to condense them as quickly as possible, but it gets a little complicated. So, technically speaking, Britain entered the war because it had an obligation from the 1839 Treaty of London to protect the neutrality and sovereignty of Belgium Now, Belgium's neutrality was being threatened in the first place because of the possibility of invasion from Germany, who mobilized for war after the Serbian attack on their Austrian ally, Franz Ferdinand. Serbia, however, was under the protection of Russia, the Russian Empire, who were allied with French Empire, which meant that Germany's declaration of war on Russia implied the invasion of France. To invade France from Germany, it's easiest to go through Belgium, which is the official reason that Britain got involved. So that's a pretty complicated series of events. And you can probably guess that the reality is actually way more complicated even than that. Now, Britain's entry into the war, I think, had to do with the long-standing competing interests of European imperial powers that obviously went far beyond Europe. All of the main players at the start of the First World War, as I was explaining, had been competing for colonial resources and land in the 19th century during the scramble for Africa, which would play out as massive military campaigns, conscription, and accelerated economic exploitation across Africa during the war. Germany, as I said, had been growing as an imperial power during the late 1800s, which resulted in international trade tension, the Franco-Prussian War between Germany and France, and a naval arms race between Britain and Germany in particular. Meanwhile, the Ottoman Empire was in decline, which piqued different imperial interests in the Middle East. So what you've got here by 1914 is this incredibly messy political hotbed causing tension all over the world. And that's making everyone very, very uneasy. There was actually a fair bit of opposition to the war within Britain. Many liberal politicians pointed out that the war was going to destroy the decades of work that had gone into regulating international trade, especially between empires and the sort of cross-national cooperation. But the conservatives, meanwhile, were urging war. They were using the invasion of Belgium and the atrocities committed by German soldiers to get the country and, by extension, the empire to act. So what we get as a result was a conflict that began in August 1914 and came to a halt in Western Europe officially on the 11th of November 1918. But in reality, that conflict stretched well into the 1920s and 30s in Eastern Europe, the Middle East, East Asia, and Africa. So historians of the First World War often challenge the idea that the war ended at all in 1918 to show just how much this was a conflict between competing empires. They argue that the war certainly didn't end for Russia, which descended into civil war, from which emerged the Soviet Union. It definitely didn't end in 1918 for, say, like Turkey, because that became a new state, partly in response to the fall of the Ottoman Empire and occupation from Allied militaries. Plenty of the international agreements that determined what our world actually looks like today, too, happened after the armistice, in the long period of violence and diplomacy that followed the end of fighting in Europe. So I think throwing out the idea that the war just came to a halt when the guns stopped on the Western Front is a really good one. I think it's a good first step to challenging how we think empires operate and also identifying what they wanted to achieve through war. What did the British Empire want to achieve? So all of the British Empire was involved in the First World War, but the reasons why are, as we've kind of suggested, not centered at all in British commemoration of the war. During the war's centenary a few years ago, lots of museums and politicians tried to talk about how global and especially racially diverse the war was by mentioning the contributions of, say, like Indian or Caribbean soldiers to the British war effort. That was a phrase that was used a lot. They contributed a lot to the war effort. So they didn't really suggest what these people were contributing to, which again brings up the question of what a Punjabi Sikh soldier might have been doing in Iraq in 1917. The short answer has to do, unsurprisingly, with the protection and continued expansion of empire, which required the mobilization of more manpower than mainland Britain could offer. So Britain at the beginning of the First World War does not have a large army, so is calling on the Empire to pick up the slack, basically. So this included, but was not limited to, over 1 million Indians, 600,000 Canadians, 400,000 Australians, 15,000 West Indians, and over 200,000 Black Africans. And those were just people affiliated with the military. So that's not counting the impact on civilians that the war had across British colonies and dominions.
Yeah, it's funny you should say that. In Canada, we have similar kind of tokenistic narratives about a diverse experience of the war, which really highlight our different Indigenous soldiers and Japanese and Chinese and Black soldiers that went off to fight. But it also doesn't acknowledge how much the Canadian contribution was really about asserting its own place within an empire and its own status as one of the stronger dominions within the empire itself. And in lots of ways, it forgets that the purpose of the war was to enact imperial rivalry.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's complicated, but also really important to examine how those narratives are being presented. You know, often those are really a big source of pride for especially marginalized and Indigenous communities, which I think is important to respect. Also realizing that a lot of mostly white politicians use those to, and certainly use those at the time, to justify the war's aims and sort of pan-imperial unity, which I think is a good thing to keep in the back of the mind.
Yeah, it's always a tension between the memory of something in form of celebration and how that celebration is used to justify not just historical past injustice, but also modern inequality.
And yeah, and that's clearly not limited to the British Empire, because France itself also brought a lot of soldiers coming from the colonies who were often called the indigenous troops, being part of the French army during the First World Conflict. And this is also a narrative that is very much struggling to find its way into the kind of the public discourse in France. It's still very much, because a lot of the trenches were in between France and Belgium, it's still very much focusing on this history of the trenches and on those spaces within France, as if the First World War or the world stage was very much in France during that war when it wasn't.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you can see with the British and French comparison how those different empires conceptualize race as well. So Black Senegalese troops in France were really positioned as these, with martial race ideas of them being sort of sharp troops and much tougher than white soldiers, whereas Britain did not want to have Black soldiers at all. They, you know, really leaned into the martial race idea with especially Punjabi Indians. Most Black African troops, different for Black Caribbean, but Black African troops, in the British military were in non-combatant roles. So mobilizing all these people, as you can imagine, was really, really complicated. It meant confronting the vast reality of what the empire actually looked like and how it did or didn't work as an institution. For many, it rapidly accelerated processes of globalization and immigration, and it put white authorities into closer contact with the centuries of racism and oppression that they themselves had perpetrated. For example, Brighton's Royal Pavilion, which many of you may have seen, it's this big, beautiful building in the center of Brighton, was designed, is designated as a hospital for Indian soldiers during the early years of the war. This forced authorities to implement culturally specific facilities like separate water supplies for Muslims and Hindus. And it brought imperial forms of racism home to Britain, with hospital authorities scrambling to train up white male orderlies to treat Indian soldiers so that white English nurses would not come into contact with brown men. Some of the pavilion's present-day boundaries and gardens actually date back to the war, because racial intermixing led to Indian soldiers' visits like into the city of Brighton being chaperoned and monitored. They put up fences around the pavilion sometimes so people couldn't easily see each other you have to remember that many of these soldiers in Brighton Pavilion were illiterates. They were often from north of India, from very rural communities. And as the war went on, they were subjected to harsher forms of conscription and the profound disruption of their home communities, labor, and families. We see this threat of First World War conscription as being a real catalyst for anti-imperial struggle across colonial contexts. So that brings me to my first point, which is talking about this anti-colonial rebellion that is really fermented and catalyzed during the First World War. In the British Empire, this massive years-long mobilization for the war on the Western Front and elsewhere meant that people who were subject to British imperialism were getting real incentive to question and seek agency in new ways when thinking about their relationship to empire. So I really think this is one of the processes that is inseparable from the war. It's just as significant as its formal uniformed military campaigns. People came at this challenge to empire that was being posed by the war from different directions. Early on, some nationalists in colonized countries encouraged men who were technically British subjects to participate in the war as part of the British military. The rationale was that it might lead to Britain respecting demands for autonomy and equal treatment. So one of these people, this might be a surprising fact, was the Jamaican activist and Black nationalist leader, Marcus Garvey, whose work would later influence the rise of the Black Panther Party and Rastafarianism and a lot of ideas of Pan-Africanism. When war broke out in Europe, Garvey's Pan-African organization, the Universal Negro Improvement League, telegrammed London, quote, expressing our loyalty and devotion to His Majesty the King and Empire, praying for the success of British arms on the battlefields of Europe and Africa and at sea, end quote. So as the war went on, we see a wave of rebellions and revolts, often continuations of pre-war anti-colonial resistance. So I might give you all a question, which is just thinking about it practically, like, why do you think these rebellions might have been happening during the First World War? What things could have factored into people choosing this moment to organize against the British Empire?
So I'm thinking maybe, for instance, like quite closer to home, maybe the Easter Uprising in Ireland. And I guess this comes at a point when there's lots of discourses about rights and duty. And, well, the people living in the British colonies or in Ireland as part of the United Kingdom are demanded to fulfill a certain duty. They still have unequal rights, and that feels like there's something completely off in the deal that they're being offered.
Yeah, absolutely. That's definitely a big part of it. You know, with Ireland, you have the context of, decades of really virulent political discourse about this question of home rule. And some people in Ireland take the war as an opportunity to engage, not just politically, but, you know, militarily, when there's so many British troops literally off the streets. You know, the policing has really changed in Ireland.
You also see how suddenly individuals across the world are being asked to go against not just their own interests, but also their cultural beliefs. In our previous episode on the conquest in Asia, Irvi Kaitan, who was speaking, talked about how her grandfather had gone in the First World War across the ocean, and how this was a really big step because he lost his caste by crossing the ocean. And so there's a lot of cultural reasons not to. And it's really a lot to ask of someone to cross the world, leave behind your family, everything you've known, and potentially risk your life. Now, the British have been doing this for centuries, of course, but a British soldier who left to go across the world for conquest, you know, in Africa, Asia, and North America, they got something out of it. Their country benefited from those conquests. Whereas when you're asking individuals who've been conquered to go and fight for their conquerors, like, what's the incentive for that? In fact, it's much better for them to learn how to fight and then rebel.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really good segue, actually, into an example I want to bring up, which encapsulates some of these things that you guys have mentioned. I want to tell you a little bit about the Chilembwe Uprising, which took place in January of 1915 in Nyasaland, which is present-day Malawi. Like many of the anti-colonial rebellions that took place during the First World War, the Chilembwe Uprising wasn't particularly successful in practical terms at the time. But I want to talk about it because it speaks to some of the really fundamentally imperial dimensions of the war and also this emerging global anti-imperial movement that is also present in something like the Easter Rising, another unsuccessful rising that tapped into something deeper going on. So as a little background to the Chilembwe Uprising, Nyasaland is a small region that was part of the, at the time, the British Central Africa Protectorate, with, at the time of the First World War, an estimated population of just under 1 million people. Like other British African colonies, it was governed by racial principles defined in part by people like Cecil Rhodes, with the result of Black Africans being qualified as lesser to white British people, or even Asian British subjects, and disenfranchised of much of their communal land. So as a young man, John Chilembwe, who is a Black African from Nyasaland, he worked for a white English missionary. They had a close relationship, and the missionary eventually took him to the United States. In the United States, Chilembwe studied at the Virginia Theological Seminary and College, and he became exposed to African-American intellectuals and organizers like Booker T. Washington, for example, who really influenced how he returned to Southern Africa. When he returned home, Chilembwe set up his own mission to create spaces of education, worship, and political thought for Black Africans, which provoked some really targeted racist attacks from wealthy white landowners. So during the First World War, forced conscription and disease hit Nyasaland hard, which really radicalized Chilembwe's convictions toward armed revolt. So conscription is something that we haven't talked about too much, but that was a real big catalyst in a lot of anti-colonial rebellion. It's this idea that, you know, you're going into often a rural region, getting every able-bodied man that can effectively wipe out your, you know, agriculture, your families, and really profoundly impact, you know, the growth of a community. So we have some of Chilembwe's letters and public writing, including his condemnation of the British use of African troops and porters to counter the German invasion of Nyasaland in the autumn of 1914. So I'll read a little bit from this letter that he wrote. Quote, "Regarding this worldwide war, we understand that this was not a royal war, nor a government war, nor a war of gain for any description. It is a war of free nations against a devilish system of imperial domination and national spoliation. If this were a war as above mentioned, such as war for honor, government gain of riches, etc., we would have been boldly told, let the rich men, bankers, titled men, storekeepers, farmers, and landlords go to war and get shot. Instead, the poor Africans who have nothing to own in this present world, who in death leave only a long line of widows and orphans in utter want and dire distress, are invited to die for a cause which is not theirs. It is too late now to talk of what might or might not have been. Whatsoever be the reasons why we are invited to join in the war, the fact remains we are invited to die for Nyasaland. We leave all for the considerations of the government, and that justice win." So this letter was censored by local authorities when he tried to publish it in the regional newspaper, but John Chilembwe's message resonated with many. I find this letter really fascinating because he does gesture to this idea of a wider British imperial community. I think it's important to recognize that that existed to an extent, and that a bit like Marcus Garvey, he's using these early phases of the war to articulate a sense of community and mutual responsibility, albeit one that the British have not kept up their end of the deal on. But at the same time, he's clearly calling the war on Europe as he sees it playing out, with German soldiers literally appearing in familiar places in southern Africa. And he says, you know, it is now too late to talk of what might or might not have been. Now, just a few months after he wrote this letter, John Chilembwe and about 200 men tried a coordinated attack on British-run estates, with the hope that this would inspire people, particularly people whose families were affected by conscription, to organize further. Though his rebellion was swiftly put down and Chilembwe and many of his co-conspirators were killed, he was often referenced in future Malawian independence movements. And today he's very much still a part of the mythology of the state. He's on Malawian currency. The 15th of January, which was the day of the uprising in 1915, is commemorated as a national holiday. So it's really essential to understand that this rebellion and related anti-colonial movement was not just a consequence of the First World War, but it was an active part of its belligerencies and cultural change. So that should give you some ideas for thinking about the anti-colonial rebellion that was the first part of this talk. Now I want to move on to the creation of the White Commonwealth, which is the second part of this discussion about the imperial dimensions of the First World War. So we see this process of nation building and empire reshaping. Yeah. We see this process of nation building and empire reshaping happening in white dominion countries during World War II. Often we see empires as just straightforward relationships between colonizers and colonized. This gets a little complicated for the First World War with majority white countries like Canada and Australia, who were developing their own nationhoods after decades of settler colonialism, but were also very much participating in the British war effort. So in terms of land, as I said, the British Empire was the biggest it ever was immediately after the First World War. This is basically due to Britain profiting from the spoils of winning the war. It's the last big burst of British and French imperial expansion that has created some of the most charged conflicts in recent history. So there I'm thinking especially about the 1916 Sykes-Picot Agreement, which essentially carved up the modern Middle East into what post-colonial theorist Edward Said described as an imagined geography that's allowed the West to, quote, manage and even produce the Orient, end quote, often to violent ends. However, the toll of the First World War and later of the Second really strained Britain's ability to manage an empire as it had done in the 19th century. And what's sometimes not included in thinking about that process is the increasing independence of Britain's white majority settler colonial states from the late 19th century onwards. The British Commonwealth emerged as an idea during the First World War and was put forward in earnest at the Paris Peace Conference in 1919. In 1926, the Commonwealth became a formal institution of countries, quote, equal in status, in no way subordinate to one another in any aspect of their domestic or external affairs, though unified by common allegiance to the crown. Though this wasn't directly cited as the reason, practically speaking, these promises really extended to the white citizens of independent countries who had participated in the First World War. So originally Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and South Africa. So what are these things, what do these countries all have in common? What do you see as linking these countries when I mention those?
Can you name the countries again?
Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and South Africa.
Well, they're very far, very far away.
They're very much, as you said, a white settler majority countries that have generally displaced indigenous populations to be settled by white Europeans.
Yeah, they're quite different from like colonies such as, I don't know, India, which is very much about trade, and all the Caribbean, which were about that plantation economy. Like, you have lots of people moving from Britain or from European countries to settle permanently into those countries.
Yeah, absolutely. You're capturing this idea of movement and, you know, a lot of cultural exchange as well as resource exchange between these countries. So which I think is really important for thinking about how these countries are then conceptualizing themselves during and after the war. There, it's significant as well that the white members of these countries are also considered to have sort of equal status within the British military during the war. They are not regulated in the same way as, say, British Indian soldiers, members of the British Indian Army. Now, of course, many British people during the First World War may not have seen it as strange or jarring, or that these countries were participating in the war alongside mainland Britain. There's a great propaganda poster made in London in 1915 with, it's a picture of a big maned lion standing on a kind of like Pride Rock situation. And he's surrounded by four young male lions who are labeled Canada, Australia, India, and New Zealand. And the caption reads, "The empire needs men, all answer the call. Helped by the young lions, the old lion defies his foes, enlist now." So even if these countries and their trajectories out of immediate British control were really different, it absolutely served the British government to portray them as being united in a common struggle.
Yeah, I think I've seen this exact poster in the Imperial War Museum in London.
Yeah. And the Imperial War Museum is always an interesting one because that very much came out of the First World War. So the way that the empire is portrayed and the choice of that poster to portray imperial relations is always an interesting one for me.
I mean, it's literally called the Imperial War Museum. I think if nothing says that the First World War was about empire, the name of that museum does.
Yes. Clues of the name. So, of course, there was a lot of talk about this sort of cross-imperial cooperation. But for the countries themselves, these especially white settler colonial countries, the war had a really different impact to the way it was received in Britain, which is that it had a really tremendous and demonstrable impact on shaping these countries' ideas of white nationhood. I think we can read this as a symptom of British cultural imperialism, which still keeps hold in especially these countries with majority white populations. I mentioned earlier that 600,000 Canadians supplemented the British military, and indeed they were central to the Western Front's, many of the Western Front's bloodiest military conflicts, like the opening days of the Battle of the Somme. Paula, I don't know if you visited the Canadian Parliament, but it's always struck me that it's sort of themed around the First World War. I don't know if you visited.
I haven't seen the Parliament buildings in a very long time, but the idea of the First World War is definitely a huge part of the Canadian nationality. The birth of Canada, although it technically happened in 1867, is culturally defined as in the First World War, and not just in the First World War, but during like a single battle on a single ridge during the First World War. It's called Vimy Ridge. And it's seen as like this moment in which the nation itself was born. So it really has boiled down the entirety of the national legacy to, you know, like a handful of soldiers on a specific battlefield at a specific moment in time. And even still, this battle itself is kind of over-celebrated just because it was convenient to choose that battle. I mean, there was much more significant battles that Canadian soldiers fought in, for instance, at Cambrai. But the Vimy Ridge one has been signified as the moment in which Canada's nation was born. And if you go visit Vimy Ridge today, you'll see a very large, beautiful memorial of Lady Canada weeping for her fallen soldiers. So the Canadian nationhood is highly, you know, centered around this narrative of the First World War. And what you were saying about white nationality is another significant portion of this, because even though today we recognize and celebrate the contributions, as I said, of the different ethnic groups of Canada, the solidification of Canadian nationhood also went hand in hand with the solidification of Canadian whiteness. The first 20 years of the 20th century, between 1900 and 1920, is a moment in which Canada saw the largest influx of immigrants it has ever in history ever seen. And as soon as the war ended in 1920, you have the Canada pass a complete ban on any Chinese immigration, for instance. So as time goes on, there's stricter controls on who's allowed to come into the country. because they had this huge influx, and this concern is that there's just going to be too many people who aren't of Anglo-Saxon descent. And so they are incredibly strict then after that. Then Canada even, for instance, starts internment camps of its own in the First World War, specifically against Ukrainians, who were seen at the time as a different race of people. And then, of course, Germans and later Japanese during the Second World War. So the idea of interning, you know, those considered foreign, and especially not those considered Anglo, is a very big part of Canadian nationhood too. And then it really goes hand in hand with this narrative of that First World War being the birth of a nation itself.
I think it's quite interesting to think that for like white settler colonies, the start of the national history is very much linked to the First World War, because in a very strong sense, it reinforces the idea that the start of the national history starts with this involvement of white settlers in this conflict within the British military. I guess maybe it contributes to erase the stories and the narratives and the presence of the indigenous population of Australia, New Zealand, Canada, even more.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, you know, those indigenous, again, contributions to the war effort are often put forward instead of the history of those people literally being there before the nation was built. The Canadian Parliament that I was thinking of, it, you know, of course, Canada became independent and formed in 1867. But the original Parliament building burned down during the war, actually, unrelated to the war, just burned down. But when they rebuilt it, they very much chose it to be almost a memorial in many ways to Canada's war dead. The houses of government are covered with paintings of First World War battlefields. Similarly, Australian losses at Gallipoli are a huge part of the national myth of Australia. They were often cited by far-right politicians, including during the First World War itself, as justification for the continuation of the White Australia policy, which originally forbade non-white immigration to Australia from 1901. There's actually a really striking moment in the Paris Peace Conference where Japan asked to be an exception to that White Australia policy to allow Japanese immigration to Australia. And so we see a tension in that negotiation of Australia's sort of white citizenry idea that's coming out of the war. So the choice to center explicitly imperial participation in the First World War is a distinctive one. And I think it's significant that it isn't shared by a majority white, Britain affiliated, although my Irish family would not let me say it, a country like Ireland, which has had its fair share of wartime losses in the First World War, but really strikingly does not commemorate the First World War on a national scale. Instead, what, you know, was commemorated in 2016 was the Easter Rising, that sort of failed uprising, which later sparked the Irish War of Independence, which is also commemorated. And I think that, that tells a particular story about, the impact of cultural imperialism and how choosing to align yourself with a British history, a British and imperial, sort of self-ideation really does change not just how people think of themselves, but policy and how we tell the stories of history. So I'll wrap up by saying I think the case of Ireland, really speaks to the war. I think that this idea of white nationhood coming out of the war really speaks to the First World War as being far more than the sum of its casualties. So literally, far more than the number of poppies that adorned the Tower of London a few years ago, or even the number of war graves, marked and unmarked, spread across the world. Rather, as we get further away from the First World War and that crisis passes from living memory into mythology, we can see more clearly the deep, profound rifts and continent-shaping grooves it's left in our present. It's shaped how we think about race and nationhood, not just in our day-to-day experiences, but in the laws and maps that enforce those. It's arguably driven most of the world-changing events of the 20th century, its global scope often hitting hardest in places that still get left out of British tellings of the war. The First World War offset and rearranged the imperial powers that have driven our world for centuries, with the British Empire renegotiating its place in the world as America came to the fore. So if nothing else, I hope I leave you with an opening up of your perspective on the First World War beyond the trenches of the Western Front, and hopefully thinking about the ways in which empire still structures our lives and histories, even after what we would consider, say, the fall of the British Empire. So thank you very much for having me.
Well, that was really enlightening. Thank you, Jack, for that really great discussion of the imperial aspects of the First World War.
It was super impressive how we managed to pack so many topics within this short podcast, but I think it was also very enlightening.
Yes, thank you very much. You've clearly expanded the reach both globally and culturally of this war.
It'd be honestly really interesting to hear about other uprisings and conflicts that happened in different areas of the world too, because I think that a lot of our listeners will have never heard of Chilembwe's uprising itself. And hearing more of those stories really helps to reframe the narrative of celebration that and memory and loss that is the British and Canadian and other colonial narratives of the First World War conflict. So that has been the end of episode 7 of A Very Brief Introduction to the British Empire, and it's also the end of our second module on New Imperialism. Our next module will begin on the topic of unmaking empire, and we'll be discussing the interwar period. This podcast is brought to you by Uncomfortable Oxford. If you're interested in following us and learning more about our activities, please find us on Facebook, Twitter, or at our webpage, www.uncomfortableoxford.com. We will have a bit of a hiatus before our next episode because we're going to be running one lecture a month. We are proudly supported by Torch, the Oxford Network for the Humanities at the University of Oxford. And the music you'll be hearing is Wishful Thinking by Dan Leibowitz.